So I was a little bit unsure about whether to give a talk today or whether, since I'm going to be gone for a while, it's often nice to take the time for questions and answers. But I decided I would give a talk unless the strong upwelling of desire for a Q&A period, just to flesh out, hear about the different issues that the community has and what you'd like to talk about. What I'd like to talk about is ethics. And in particular about conflict resolution. And I had various ideas went through my mind about how to make this talk, how to present it. I decided some of them were too artificial and too contrived. But maybe I'll tell you about them. And you know, I'll tell you about the contrived nature of some of my ideas so that the wise part of it, you can kind of just imagine and take it in, and if there is any. I was going to tell you a story about that I've told many times, a little story, a little saying about Zen. The saying is that Zen is two things. It's zazen, which means Zen meditation, and sweeping the temple courtyard, or the monastic courtyard. And the understanding of that is that the monastic courtyard doesn't end at the boundaries of the courtyard or boundaries of the temple, the monastery. It's saying there's two aspects to Zen practice. There's sitting and meditation, either literally or symbolically, and then there's engaging in the world, taking care of what needs to be taken care of. When the pathways in the monastery are dirty, you sweep them. When there is conflict in the world, you deal with the conflict. So you respond to the world, you take care of the world, and both those things are important. And so, and those things go hand in hand; they go together. You want to be able to do both. Both of them support each other and make each other healthy. And both of them test each other. Your zazen, in a sense, your meditation, is tested by your engagement in the world. And you find out, is it really real? You know, have you really changed in a healthy way? Have you really understood something deeply? And then you bring it into the world and see how the world responds, how you respond, what happens. And if you just stayed in your own meditation the whole time, stayed in your monastery, and never were tested, never put yourself in a situation where you really see what's happened for you, then you won't know for sure and who you are. You'll kind of live in kind of a idealistic utopia. And then also there's an opportunity to learn from what we see then. So you go into the world and you find out, oh, I'm much more attached than I realized around this particular thing or that particular thing or everything. So this is where one of the places where I need to continue practicing. And also it kind of then helps with a certain kind of healthy humility that is very good to have, I think, in practice. And then conversely, our engagement with the world is tested, in a sense, by going on retreat, by sitting in meditation. That many of us, because it's often possible to be fooled in daily life, to think that you're much more free than you actually think you are. And only by sitting in meditation, only by going on retreat, does the mind quiet down enough that you can really see what's going on in the mind. Oh, I didn't know that. I was so preoccupied about that. I'm so obsessing about that. I'm actually, you know, so you can start seeing kind of what's underneath the surface chatter of the mind. And you start saying, oh. And I've had the experience, and I know other people have had the experience, of feeling, you know, everything's just fine, in a sense, some kind of level. And then going on retreat or sitting in meditation, and say, oh. Oh. So the two go hand in hand. So, and part of what meditation is coming to some place of clarity, of calm, some modicum of it at least, of stability, of being centered. And then engagement in the world is to take that calm or that centered and bring it into the world. And And you don't have to go back and forth literally, you know, run to your cushion every time you lose your calm. But that movement can continue in daily life. The movement of engaging and then finding where our center is, finding where the calm is, and it, while we're engaged. So the artificial part of this talk, which I'm not going to do then, was I was going to give a talk about conflict resolution and then tell you that part of conflict resolution is also learning how to work with your breath. Coming back to your breath, learning how to have a fluid breath, using your breath as a cue, as an aid, as a help, to understand how you're caught and how you get tight and tense, and then learning how to have a lubricated breath, learning how to breathe a relaxed way as you're involved in the conflict. So don't get so caught up in the conflict, in whatever way we're caught up in it, that you lose touch with your breath. Don't get so lost in your breath that you lose touch with the conflict. But use your breath as a tool in the middle of it, as a place to be in the middle of it. It's kind of like sometimes, and some yoga teachers will emphasize the breath a lot, and they'll talk about, you know, get into a yoga posture and stay there and find an easy breath in it. And hang in there in that posture until you can find an easy breath, a natural breath within it, a relaxed breath within that posture. And probably some of you have done yoga kind of know, you know, you get into this kind of contorted position and you can, you know, barely hold it and your breath is all tight and the yoga teacher says, you remember to breathe. And you are breathing, of course, but what they mean is remember to kind of, you know, breathe in a relaxed way, in a full way. Don't hold your breath. Don't be so tense. So you go, part of the great thing about yoga for some people is being in these kind of difficult positions that sometimes can be awkward, but then working with that position to find how to have a natural breath, an easy breath. So the same thing with conflict resolution. Coming back to the breathing, can you, in the midst of the conflict, have that easy breath, come back to your breath? So I still haven't told you the artificial part of the talk that I'm not going to do. But that was, as I gave the talk, was to have you every 5 minutes or every 3 minutes, have you all go back to your breathing, talk about the breath, kind of have the two talks, you know, weave into each other, conflict resolution and the breath. And back and forth, like two parallel talks, that, you know. And so how's your breath? But I won't do that. But it's a great idea. And someone who is really skilled at this could probably do it in a way and we'd all be enlightened at the end. I didn't feel like I had that skill, and probably, you know, I was concerned you would all be irritated with me by the end. The way I did it, so it wasn't such an important part. Maybe it was the most important part, but who knows? Excuse me. Conflict resolution. It's come up a little bit for me because I'm on the Spirit Rock Ethics Council. It's called the EAR Council. EAR Council is an acronym for Ethics and Reconciliation Council, EAR. And that was chosen intentionally because one of the primary functions of the Ethics Council, the EAR Council, is to be an ear, is to listen to people, is to listen, and to be a place for confidential listening to people's concerns around ethics and conflict. The San Francisco Zen Center also has an EAR Council. And so it's kind of nice that these two Buddhist traditions that come from very different places in Asia, Japanese Zen and Southeast Asian Theravada Buddhism, both have a EAR Council. Isn't that amazing? It's not so amazing because I wrote the document for both of them. And my hope is that the idea will spread. And there's come up a little bit the idea that we should have such a council here in our center, and I'm starting to talk preliminary talks with people about us starting one here. And as far as I know, there's no reason in terms of having conflict that I know of particular. But no one's come up, but that I know. But it's always good to have these things in place. They started off, you know, in the 1980s there were a lot of conflict. with teachers in American Buddhist communities. And a lot of people felt betrayed by the Buddhist teachers, and the Buddhist teachers did various unethical things. And so by the early 90s, some of the Buddhist centers, some of the Buddhist teachers in the, and members of the communities started feeling the need for teacher codes of ethics. And I believe Jack Kornfield was probably one of the first to do this, produced a Vipassana Teacher's Codes of Ethics, and then had a very started a kind of an ethics council for Spirit Rock. And then a little bit later, the abbots at San Francisco Zen Center suggested that San Francisco Zen Center have something similar, and that then they had they started having meetings to try to had a subcommittee to try to come up with some document and some procedures for that. I think that was 1992 that the abbots started that. Yeah, they started that in the Zen Center. And so it was in response to teachers' ethics. And in both communities, what arose out of consideration for this was to not limit it to issues around the teachers, when there's, you know, teachers have done some transgression, but rather to be a place for deal with tension and conflicts within the community themselves, in the and might have to do with community members, or in San Francisco or Spirit Rock between, you know, practitioners and administrators or people, employees, and, you know, for everybody concerned, some place to go and deal with conflict. Jack Kornfield once told me, gave a little kind of history of how conflict, teacher conflict, transgressions had been dealt with in the Vipassana community. In the, now it's been probably 30 years that he's been part of it in America. And overall, the Vipassana community has not had the kind of level of scandal. As far as I know, there hasn't been any scandals in the Vipassana community. There certainly have been things which have been somewhat, maybe there have been scandals, but some unethical things. But well, I shouldn't even say this, but anyway. So he went through a history, and he said the first approach was when there was a teacher, actually an American teacher who was, I think maybe as early as late 1960s, who was teaching here, early 70s, teaching here in America. And there was something, he did something inappropriate. And his elders in Burma basically excommunicated him. Just, you're out of here. That was approach number one. Approach number two was there was a Asian teacher who came to America who was supposed to live a life of celibacy and kind of broke that. And when that became known, the first approach to the community was denial and avoidance of the issue. And so that was approach number two. And the third approach is that approach of going and talking to people and having a process in place to try to work things out, understand all the elements of it, what's really went on, understand what goes on in people's psyche when they did what they did, and to look for healing, look for reconciliation, look for atonement, look for processes that includes people in the within the community, keeps them in or has a way of bringing them back in. So it's not, you know, either way. It's not you know, reject people or deny that something's happened, but have a healthy process in place. And in the monastic rules, there are lots of processes like that that helps reinstitute people in good standing within the community after they've done some kind of transgression. And one of our very revered American Dharma teachers, who was a monk in Southeast Asia, talks about breaking one of the very important rules that you're not supposed to break, having to do with celibacy. He masturbated. And so he had to go and confess to his teacher. Okay, so there's a process then in place what to deal with it so he can come back into community good standing. I think he had to stand at the temple gate for some days or a week. And every monk that came in, he had to explain why he was standing there. And after that week, then he was invited back in good standing. And so, hopefully we won't have exactly that kind of process here. But to have some kind of healthy process in place. Why? Why have a healthy process? I like to think of it because it's an extension, it's an expression of the basic Buddhist practice itself. That basic Buddhist practice involves never turning away from suffering, never turning away from conflict, unless it's healthy to do that. Sometimes it's maybe healthy to do that for all kinds of reasons, but there's a lot, mostly unhealthy reasons to turn away. We never turn away from suffering and conflict, because that's where the path is found. That's where the Buddhist path is found, is by going into the places where attachment, conflict reside, breathing, finding where to be relaxed, finding how to be free in the midst of it, finding how to work with it. So in both both Zen Center and Spirit Rock have these documents, and talking about their respective ear councils. I'd like to read a little bit from both of them. At Zen Center, it says, "We wish our life within the Zen Center Sangha to express our Zen practice and Bodhisattva intention." The Bodhisattva intention is that intention to be helpful to all beings, to help liberate all beings. So it comes out of compassionate concern for the well-being of everyone. "As the Bodhisattva path is our heartfelt response to suffering, turning away or skimming over suffering through silence, rationalization, assigning blame, minimizing, feeling self-deprecating guilt, or not listening deeply to its causes and conditions are all steps directed away from the Bodhisattva path itself." So turning away or skimming over suffering. And then he goes through a list of all the ways that, some of the ways people can do that, are all steps directed away from the Bodhisattva path itself. "Furthermore, avoidance is a condition for additional suffering. Thus, when a conflict, grievance, dissonance, or violation of the precepts arises in our interpersonal relationships, it is essential to attend to it fully. Personally, this involves waking up to our own contribution to the suffering in these situations through understanding our reactions, emotions, and attachments. Interpersonally, this involves taking the time to discuss the conflict with the other parties involved in an attempt to clarify the actual causes, conditions, feelings, and responses that come together in the situation. What follows are guidelines and procedures for resolving conflicts and transgressions within the Zen Center Sangha. It is our hope that such resolutions take the form of reconciliation with oneself and with others." So here there's two parts. There's a personal part and the interpersonal part. And both are important. Sometimes people forget one or the other part. What I found very often at Zen Center when I was there was that people there tend to take things very personally, in the sense of, if there's conflict, I must be the cause of it. And so people didn't sometimes enter into the into discussion about it, because, oh, it's all up to me. I have to deal with it myself, my own attachments and things. And it might be that really the other person needs to attend to something, but still, they took it on themselves. And I told this story before, but it was... this document for Zen Center was late for Zen Center. You know, it needed it earlier because of the issues they had to develop. And one of the reasons Zen Center needed this document earlier was to deal with the level of conflict and hostility that arose in the community in trying to write this document. And it blew me away. It was just amazing. Partly Zen has an antinomian streak in it. No rules. You're supposed to just be free. Especially among younger members, that was kind of an idealistic kind of approach. And also, so the first committee they tried to make this for Zen Center looked around to see what they could borrow from, and they borrowed from the Jungian Institute in San Francisco, their guidelines, which is a very different language than the Buddhist language. And they came, and without due process in the community, and presented these new guidelines for ethics, and the community went ballistic. The amount of hostility that I saw, I sat behind one of the members in a meeting once, and the level of hostility directed to it was amazing. And because of all the hostility, the board basically was ready to give up. They didn't know what to do anymore. They didn't know how to proceed with because it's kind of stalemate. And that's where, in my kind of way, naive way, I just jumped in and I started. I took the precepts, the Zen precepts, the 16 precepts, and used that language and just kind of typed something up, kind of redid it in that kind of language. And everybody said, oh, that's great. There's a way forward here. You be on the committee. And so I was involved in the second committee then to rework this. And we went back and forth. We were basically very good friends in the committee, but you know, it was kind of a little bit testy at times because, you know, where the comma went was really important. And we were very, commas were important. You know, we went to every single, word was kind of like analyzed as we went through this. And I remember once leaving a meeting feeling somewhat peeved at this other guy. And, we were kind of like, tense between us. And I thought about it for the week, and I realized, where I'd been attached, and I was going to go to the next meeting, and the first thing I was going to do was going to apologize to him. I got to the meeting, and before I had a chance, the first thing he did was he apologized to me for his responsibility, how he was attached. Isn't that beautiful, if both people can come like that? But sometimes that approach, we just kind of look at ourselves, sometimes can leave out the part, I have to kind of talk to someone too, work it out interpersonally. And some people want to work things out interpersonally. You're to blame. You better, and don't want to look at themselves at all. So that's the introduction to the San Francisco Zen Center's document. The Spirit Rock document, a simpler document for various reasons, but it starts off this way. Conflicts will inevitably arise within the Spirit Rock community. The health of our community is not measured by the presence or absence of conflict as much as by our willingness to find effective, responsible, and compassionate means of resolving interpersonal tensions as they arise. The health of our community is not measured by the presence or absence of conflict as much as by our willingness to find effective, responsible, and compassionate means of resolving interpersonal tensions as they arise. So the dedication, a healthy community is one that's dedicated to process, not measured by the purity, but dedicated to the commitment to process. So we never turn away from suffering. It doesn't mean that anyone, my hope, my heartfelt hope for our community here, and for any Sangha, is, again, not that a Sangha is free of conflict, but no one's rejected, no one feels uncomfortable, no one's pushed away, no one runs away because there's conflict. A Sangha is a place where we're willing to hang in there, to talk about what needs to be talked about. It doesn't mean we have to all be friends, but we're never going to close our hearts to each other. We're going to hang in there, at least to find how to keep the heart open and feel the connection there. And that process, I think, is one of the primary things of what a Sangha is. And one of the things that makes a Sangha a safe place. We're all going to make mistakes and become with all kinds of cultural conditioning, all kinds of things. But we listen to each other. If we need to, we stop. The intention to attend to and learn from conflict, the intention to attend to and learn from conflict is a clear application of Buddhist practice into our daily lives. Without this intention, practice can too easily be a comfort rather than a deep transformative vehicle for our lives. Do we want practice just to be a comfort, security blanket? Or do we want to use it to change us, to have radical transformation, to be liberated? One of the words for liberation is release. And too many people sometimes look for relief rather than release. So if you were looking for release, you have to stay there and really work with what's actually happening. Buddhist conflict resolution is not based on good or bad, blame or guilt, winning or losing, offenders or victims. What do you think of that? What's left in conflict resolution? No good or bad, no blame or guilt, no winning or losing, no offenders or victims. What do you think of that? No offenders and victims. You like that? You take care of offenders.
And victims.
And victims. He works in juvenile psych ward. And most of the people there are either victims or offenders?
Or both.
But no...
Dangerous people.
But no victims or offenders. And you like that. Both thumbs went up for that. What do you think of that, huh? So, rather, it is based on fully addressing the suffering of all concerned. That's the alternative to all those labels and all those judgments. Attending to the suffering of all of all concerned. Hurt, fear, and anger are taken seriously through forums in which everyone may speak honestly, safely, and completely about their own direct experiences and feelings. In looking for resolution, Buddhist practice values dialogue over silence, reconciliation over estrangement, forgiveness over resentment, confession over accusation, and atonement over punishment. Because the process of reaching such resolution is often very difficult, Spirit Rock's Ethics and Reconciliation Council offers support. So then, in both communities, part of the function of the Air Council is try to facilitate informal means of conflict resolution, of reconciliation. Formal means, grievance procedures that, can be instituted, are generally, we consider, not a very useful way of reaching reconciliation. If someone has a grievance and they want to, but that's necessary to have sometimes. But the Air Council is there partly to see, before doing a formal grievance procedure, can we advise people on healthy ways that lead to reconciliation, which is a higher standard than just simply settling a grievance. And so the idea was, what are the informal ways that people need to do in order to deal with conflict and disagreements? So in San Francisco Zen Center, they have basic guidelines for doing this. Although no fixed procedures for informal conflict resolution exist, the suggestions and procedures that follow are intended to give all persons involved in a dispute a chance to be fully heard in an environment of respect and kindness that flows from knowing that there's no fundamental differences between us. 1. Stating the actual. A crucial aspect of conflict resolution, just as in Buddhist practice itself, is discriminating between our interpretations and opinions of an event and how the event was or is personally experienced. In part, this means not making general statements, but rather sticking to the particulars of actual situations and the emotions experienced. It is extremely difficult to have mutual understanding when discussion remains at the level of interpretation and generalization. 2. So this is the part where I was going to go through. I thought of going through this, and then at the end of each paragraph, telling you all to breathe. But, I won't do that. Being heard. It is important that everyone be given an opportunity to be fully heard. And I don't exactly remember why it's worded that way. I don't remember what happened all those years or 10 years ago when we wrote this. But being heard, usually people say listening is really important for conflict resolution. And I think what we had in mind was that being heard is a higher standard than listening. Being heard is kind of like, you know that someone is listening. The other person has to listen carefully, and has to listen so carefully that you know you're being heard. So being heard is really important. It is important that everyone be given an opportunity to be fully heard. This means that everyone be given a chance to recount how they remember the history of a conflict, to state their feelings regarding the conflict, and to explain the goals they have for its resolution. Such statements should be neither defensive nor critical, since both approaches tend to preclude deeper mutual understanding. Much conflict arises and is perpetuated through a lack of mutual understanding. Taking calm, deliberate, and adequate time to listen to each other is often all that is needed for reconciliation to begin. So I've been on the ethics committee. I've been involved in ethics conflicts now for some various conflicts that have arisen for some time. And I've watched how I've watched ways in which they've been resolved or tried to be resolved in unhealthy ways. And one of the ways I've seen is when someone has an opinion about what the solution is or how, and tries to impose that on someone else. Or if it has some judgment about the other part of the one party. Oh, that party, you know, it's not really a real grievance that person has. Or that person, it's a grievance, all right, but that person's, you know, like, really stuck in being the victim mode or something, and you know, this is never going to end if we keep catering to this person, and so, you know, this is a difficult person, and so let's just kind of like do something here and send a letter and kind of close the door. And it's not really listening, it's not really letting someone being heard. And what I've seen when that kind of approach is taken, the few times I've seen it, it just aggravates the wound. And what I've seen often, if we stop and listen to people really carefully and give it time and listen, that's really what people sometimes most want. They want to know that someone really heard them, understood where they're at. And I've seen how sometimes the conflict dissolves when people feel like they were adequately, fully heard and listened to. And I think that some people are afraid of listening deeply because they think that there are further consequences. That, oh, then, I don't know, it'll never end that way. But I've seen over and over again now, a number of times, that just giving people a chance to be heard really well is, you know, maybe, I don't know how much, you know, it's a majority of what needs to happen. It's like in therapy, right? Your therapist doesn't even say much to you. But, you know, a lot of it is just the fact that you have a chance to talk. And in your talking is a process. Restating what was heard. To ensure that everyone understands one another, it is useful for each party to briefly restate what the other has said, highlighting the main points. The other party then says whether the restatement is complete or accurate, and if necessary, makes corrections. The next one is interesting because these three are basically, you'll find in a lot of different manuals on conflict resolution, these kinds of ideas stated, maybe different words, making I statements and restating and listening. But the next one is you don't find them in kind of, I don't think you find them in a lot of the kind of the conflict manuals that you can read about. The next one is called confession. Resolution and reconciliation is greatly facilitated if everyone involved reflects on how they may have contributed to a conflict and then explains it to the other party. Even when one person is primarily responsible, self-reflection, confession, and apology on everyone's part can provide a safer, more trusting, understanding environment for everyone to be truthful. So the idea of confession, the idea of voluntarily saying, oh, this was my part, this is what I contributed, you know, bringing it out and saying it. And you know, the word confession, you know, I don't know. I think it's a very powerful word. It's a very powerful act to confess. And I don't know, you know, in Catholicism they have this, you know, they don't call it confession anymore. Someone told me, I don't know if it's everywhere in Catholicism, but they have a new word now for going to the booth and standing at the booth and, you know, And they, now it's called something like, the word reconciliation is in the word. What is it?
Yeah,
that's all it's called?
Right.
Isn't that great? So in Catholicism, it used to be called confession. Mm-hmm. When you go to the booth and, you know, whisper, and they say, you know, do nine Hail Marys or whatever. Mm-hmm. And now it's called reconciliation. It's not called confession. I love it. But I also wonder, isn't something lost? Because I think the act of confession is actually a very powerful act. It's a very cleansing to actually state to someone else, this is, you know, someone is confidential advisor, someone, this is what I did. Just that is very powerful. And that is part of the process of reconciliation. And perhaps by renaming it reconciliations, something is lost and something is gained. It's like in Catholicism, they dropped Latin, right? Something was lost and something was gained. And then, and the rest are the has to do with in bringing in witnesses, mediators, having people help facilitate from outside in the conflict. So in the midst of all that breathing, in the midst of all that looking for that relaxed breath, what does it take for you to come back to a relaxed breathing in the midst of tension? Do you want to? Is it valuable? Can you find it? If we're looking for reconciliation, then the end result should be a state where we have a relaxed breath, a relaxed breathing again. Can we do that step by step as we go along? Can we take one step forward into the conflict and not kind of rush ahead into it, but maybe take then half a step back and go back into our breath and find that breath again. Breathe, find it, find a relaxed breath, and then take the next step, and maybe half a step back. Breathe, be with the breath. And take all the steps that it takes to be in the conflict. Stay in it, but not to be conflicted, but to look at a process to heal the conflict. And one of the ways is simply to say, I think we're in conflict now. I think there's something, or One of the first spiritual community I lived in that kind of opened the door of spirituality for me was the farm in Tennessee. It was a kind of a hippie commune. It came out of Haight-Ashbury kind of and LSD and all that. And LSD was kind of like one of the gurus of the community. And they had found that and at some point they stopped taking acid because they'd moved to Tennessee, and it wasn't, you know, wasn't legal. But they found that honesty, being honest with each other, was of equal value to LSD. If you're honest enough, you didn't need to take the acid. Isn't that saying a lot? And so one of the things that was remarkable for me with this community was if they became very sensitive to interpersonal conflict, dissonance. Things that most people, most communities, I think, could just overlook because, you know, it's no big thing. And they would stop, middle of work and middle of all kinds of things, and they'd stop and they'd work it out. And sometimes they would work it out for hours. But one of the things I noticed there in the time I lived there is that maybe the first time you had to work it out, it took hours. The second time, it took half an hour. The third time it took 5 minutes because the ground has been set. And the fourth time, all someone had to do was raise their eyebrows. And then, oh yeah, okay, this is what's happening. Okay, drop it or whatever. So that points to the idea that familiarity with working with conflict, you know, initially it can be quite difficult and easy, but hanging in there, working with it, that it gets easier and easier over time. And eventually, hopefully, it becomes something that, you know, it's very easy to resolve when things arise. So the last thing I'll say is In the early Indian Buddhist tradition, in the monastic tradition, there are all these procedures for how to deal with conflict. Some of them are similar to this. And there's one step which is not in here, we didn't do here. And that is sometimes called putting straw over the mud. And that is actually ignoring the conflict, ignoring what's going on, and in the favor of harmony. And what you find in Asian cultures, in Indian and in Buddhist cultures, that the group harmony is very, very highly valued phenomena. So much so that sometimes the expectation is that you're supposed to kind of put aside your conflict for the sake of the harmony of the group. And I say this because I think there are different cultural ways of dealing with conflict. And the way that I described here, my emphasis, kind of my interpretation of, you really hang in there, you stay in the conflict, you find the practice within the conflict, working with the conflict, I think is partly represents partly a Western or a Americanized, perhaps, or Western kind of view of interpretation of how conflict resolution happens in Buddhist circles. So to emphasize again what I just said, you find in the monastic early Indian tradition both processes, both kind of this meeting it and listening and working things out. But what you also find is sometimes, for the sake of harmony, for the sake of whatever, not bringing it up or kind of putting straw over the mud. So that's a whole topic in itself, and I just wanted to kind of stir things up a little bit after giving one particular approach and how it's done, my take. Apologize if that confuses everything. So those are my thoughts for today, and it would have been great to have had discussion. I do hope that we create our own document like this for our own community, and especially now that we have a center and we're growing, and perhaps by having a document like this and having this available, and with stressing the importance of listening and working things out, we'll never need the committee. So thank you very much.